first to the other big story of the week, where character gone awry was the clear issue, the long-awaited report into the behaviour of Australia's special forces in Afghanistan, the murder of unarmed citizens, torture, cover-ups, and a chain of command which appeared at best oblivious to quite a few people there. Many long-time observers say the warning signs were there in systemic failures, in the autonomy permitted to special forces, in their over-deployment. Ian McFedrin is a former defence correspondent for News Corp and the author of several books of first-hand reporting about the SAS and other armed forces. Ian joins me now. Well, hello and welcome to Saturday Extra, Ian.
Hi, Geraldine.
Look, in the countless interviews, Ian, with ex-Special Forces personnel and former soldiers, do you think there's surprise, or do you think that there's a sense that there's a little bit of an open secret about this?
Well, I'd say there's a mixture of views, Geraldine. I think that there's certainly been rumours swirling around for some time, but it's very, very hard to stand this stuff up. Only through the courage of a couple of whistleblowers and the good journalism of Fairfax and the ABC do we have what we're up to, along with Jeff Sengelman, the former Special Operations Commander, who was the one who had the courage to actually confront it. But, you know, there is a lot of surprise as well, because the people who have served in the regiment up until, you know, this period would never have imagined that it would have been able to come to this, whereby you had these rogue senior soldiers basically running their own show.
I'd just like, if we can, to tease that out a little bit more. I mean, obviously, particularly in the regular army, there's been concern for a while about the actual model of the special forces and the way the command structure is different, and there's the role of the officer is different, whereas the NCOs and the the lower ranks have quite a lot more power. Now, is that how you would put it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, traditionally, you know, the SAS, Special Air Service Regiment, had a very, very specific role in counterterrorism and in long-range reconnaissance. Fundamentally, they weren't war fighters. They weren't the guys who went in and kicked down the doors and killed the enemy. That was the job of the infantry or the commando regiment, the other arm of the special forces. The SAS was always traditionally a unit that was in the shadows, and very seldom would there be a crossover, you know, situation with the regulars in doing that sort of work. Now, all that changed during the Afghanistan campaign, when the political leadership decided that the best way for us to avoid casualties was to send in our most elite soldiers and to let them do that job. And that's where we've got a problem. That's where it started.
I mean, this is so interesting that it did relate back to us. It was a war of choice. We were there because we had to stand by our allies after September the 11th, and it sort of drifted. Did you detect that this shift or this drift could have had this sort of impact?
Well, I was certainly concerned that the function and the role was changing. But having said that, I was confident that the discipline and the training and the actual nature of these guys who I know, the Special Air Service guys, is such that you would never have expected them to go off the rails like this. You would have expected them to do what they always traditionally do, which is adapt and improve and move on. But, you know, time after time, being deployed time after time, and I've got to say, every one of them put their hands up to be deployed again and again. And there might be something to do with the tax-free cash that they were paid that's got a bit of a role to play here as well, but we can talk about that later. I just think that the changing role and the power that was invested in these small teams, led by a sergeant or a corporal without an officer on the ground, was a big, big mistake.
Yeah, let's just talk about that. Help us understand how those units work and how the chain of command works. Who is in charge and where are they based in relation to those on the ground in Afghanistan?
Right. Okay, so you've got the Special Operations Commander in Bungendore near Canberra. You have the SAS Commanding Officer in Perth at Swanbourne. You have the Special Operations Task Group Commander on the ground in Tarinkout in Afghanistan, inside the Special Forces Headquarters, which is a fenced off, locked gate, razor-wired compound where no other soldiers are allowed to go. So it's a very specific command headquarters. Now, from there, these teams, these small teams from the squadron, are sent out by helicopter usually or by road to do their job and to do a particular job and then come back to the base. They go out, they spend 5, 6, 7 days, maybe 1 or 2 days out doing the job, then they return.
And these teams are
five or six people big,
right?
And they're led by a patrol commander who is a senior soldier, corporal or sergeant. Now, as you read the report, you'll note that some of these senior soldiers are very much in the breach as the bullies and the killers who led this culture. Now, because there are only 5 or 6 teams, they were able to keep it secret within that small team to the point where they actually falsified reports back to their headquarters and took photographs of dead Afghans with guns and radios and hand grenades, whatever the props they had on them. Now, this reached such ridiculous levels that someone noticed that one AK-47 rifle, enemy rifle, was pictured in several dead bodies, with several dead bodies. That's how ridiculous it became. So,
where's the officer during all this time?
The officer's still back in the base at Tarin Kaut. Now, the officer might occasionally go out. Some officers, like captains or majors, may occasionally go out on patrol and lead a bigger operation with a larger force, but it's really these small teams that's the issue. They go out in these small teams, they live together, they eat together, they are together very, very closely and are able to be controlled by these bullying sergeants and corporals who are threatening these guys. If they break the code, there will be consequences.
Where are the regular army? So the regular army who are there, would they be brought into, the Tarin Kaut headquarters and so on, or not?
The Special Operations Headquarters was inside the Tarin Kaut Camp Russell headquarters of the regular forces. It's a separate compound. I lived in the Tarin Kaut compound for some time during my 6 trips over there, and I was always amazed by this separate compound up on the hill where these guys with beards, you always know the special forces guys because they've always got beards. Every other regular soldier shaves every day, has to. So the bearded guys would wander up to this compound and, you know, punch the code into the lock and go in. And then that's the last you'd see of them until they came out again. And you might have seen them go off on a job on the helicopter, or you might see them come back again, or you might see them getting a cup of coffee, but they never mixed with anybody else. They always stayed separate.
And one of the things you raise as a factor here is the way the role of those men, the special forces, changed over time in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us more, please.
Well, in the war in Iraq, 2003, and this is where I wrote my book based on that war, they were the reconnaissance force for the Americans. So they would go out in their long-range patrol vehicles and identify targets, particularly missile launch targets, Scud missile launch targets. They were trying to prevent the Iraqis from launching missiles into Israel. And they would find targets, and they would then call in American airstrikes or British airstrikes or whatever, doing their job, which was to sit
highly skilled, obviously,
in the sand dunes for days on end and watch and listen and just observe and report. Occasionally, they'd come across an enemy force, and they would have to fight and take some prisoners, and they did that. But the fundamental role was not to fight. Now, when Afghanistan came around, the role that they promoted as they went around the Central Command headquarters in Florida was, we can do this special long-range reconnaissance job better than anyone else. And the American generals bought that, and that was true. The Australians were the best in the world at this job. Now, the big problem was when they went back in. When they went back in, the role started to change. They went from this long-range reconnaissance, secret squirrel stuff, to starting to kick down doors. And that became the problem. That was enhanced by the rotations, you know, one time and a time again, some of them doing, you know, 5, 6 rotations in there.
They were involved in search and destroy missions, weren't they, as opposed to long-range reconnaissance, which is a fundamental shift in mission.
Correct. Search and destroy, search and kill, that's correct. That's exactly right. And that was the problem.
This is the crucial thing. How many people at the top, either in politics or in the military, did grasp that this was a risk? Did people grasp that there were some real pressures and risks here?
You know, sending troops to war is the job of the government, and the buck stops with the Prime Minister and the Minister for Defence. But when the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defence are being advised that everything's coming up roses, everything's sweet, then it's hard for them to know without being advised somehow that there is a problem. So, you know, I know Brereton was quite, he absolved the politicians of blame. The only thing I would say about that is politicians should be very careful about lining themselves up with elite forces.
Why should you be careful?
Because you've got a small number of people in this force. You don't want to either tire them out, basically wreck them through over-deployment, or see what we've seen happen in this situation. I mean, these are the consequences of that, but obviously you can't foresee those consequences. But the generals and the colonels and the brigadiers along the chain of command, and Angus Campbell was quite sincere about this in his press conference yesterday when he said, well, we're all asking ourselves, what did we know? What did we walk past? Something
we
should have? What did we miss? I mean, it's a serious failure of command.
What real chance of cultural change would you say, Ian, knowing them as you do, in the wake of this, given that the whole model of special forces is different to regular army?
Yes, and I think that's right. And I really would caution against throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. You've got to be careful not to alter the structure of the functional structure of the place too much, because, you know, they do a pretty good job. They're very, very good at the work they do. Obviously, there's this sort of some kind of bad area that's developed, and that needs to be cut out and excised, but don't go too far. I mean, taking two squadron off the order of battle is a major thing. It might sound very minor to the average listener, but it's a very, very important thing in the army. Let's not go too far in terms of changing the fundamental tactics, techniques, and procedures of this organisation. Let's just ensure that the culture of bullying and demigods and killers in these ranks of senior soldiers never, ever develops again. Now, that's not such a big challenge, I put to you.
Well, I hope you're right. Ian McFedrin, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
No worries, Geraldine. Thank you.
And Ian's books include The Amazing SAS, published by HarperCollins, and congratulations to the ABC's Mark Willesey. He and his team have won the Gold Walkley Award, awarded last night for his expose of the alleged war crimes on Four Corners. A really well-deserved award, I hope you agree.